I decided to, let me tell you a little bit about how I decided to talk with you about love and friendship over the course of the next 2 weeks, and then lay out a basic plan for this week and next, bearing fully in mind that many of you will be here just for one class and some for two and so forth and so on. Rest assured that each one is planned to be self-contained, but nonetheless I thought I would lay out the whole two-week plan. And then today, talk about the birth of Eros, which I will explain in due course. When I heard that the theme for the village this summer was No Longer Strangers, it occurred to me to wonder what the opposite of strangerhood might be. And a number of things occurred to me. In a political context, in public life, I thought of a book that I sometimes teach, because my background is in American history and humanities, a book called Strangers in the Land, which is a book by John Higham, and it's about immigrants, and more exactly, it's about nativism, that is, the opposition that developed in this country to various immigrant groups, especially around the turn of this century. So the opposite of stranger in that context might be something like citizenship. In another context, the opposite of stranger might be something like adoption, something like being incorporated into a real or figurative family as a son or a daughter or a relative, or adoption by baptism into the family of Christ. So that's another family of opposites to strangerhood. But then I think we speak often in our culture today about people feeling estranged, alienated, lonely. And here, when we're speaking about a kind of spiritual sense of loneliness or being apart or being unable to connect, it seemed to me that in the neighborhood of the opposites to strangerhood or alienation or estrangement were words like love, and words like friendship. And it then occurred to me that you can't pick up a paper today or a news magazine without reading very soon something about what people take to be the kind of crisis, and that word is overused to the point of banality, but some kind of difficulty or systematic trouble in the way in which human beings in our culture relate to one another. In how we manage our loves, whether we even know what love is, whether or not love and friendship in any rich and deep sense have begun in some sense to disappear from our culture, or at least to take on forms that would have been strange to our parents and grandparents and to most of Western culture prior to this time. And so it seemed to me that another way of getting at some of the things that the theme of the village means to lift up, No Longer Strangers, was to really spend a couple of weeks thinking and talking about love and friendship. I propose this week to be talking about mainly erotic love. The titles are Strange Lovers, : The Birth of Eros. And that will mean that we'll look at a world very different from our own. Ancient Greece, out of which a certain classic text, which we will look at together, short story arose, kind of a myth that tried to get at the nature of erotic longing, what it is, how it arose, and so on. And then on Wednesday, look at another very different world, the world of the medieval West, and we'll look at another snatch of a text called The Art of Courtly Love, which was perhaps the first how to do it manual. You go to a bookstore today and you see whole shelves of how to improve relationships, how to win friends and influence people, how to, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're going to look at probably one of the earliest in that genre called The Art of Courtly Love. And that will open up a very different world to us from the world of ancient Greece and from our present day. And my suspicion is that as we work through a little bit these small texts, there's not a lot to read together, there's some, we'll discover a couple of interesting things. One, we'll be, I think, from time to time startled to see how much of the wisdom in those texts still applies to our present condition, describes the character of our longings and our friendships. Two, we'll be surprised to learn that some of the things that we find most troubling about those texts remain haunting some of our behaviors and feelings today. And three, we'll get a kind of very different vantage point in these rather different contexts for looking at our practices, and I think we might find a number of them wanting by comparison to the kinds of things that are lifted up in those texts. So there will be a lot of things going on in the course of reading those together. So I have a handout, which I'm going to distribute in a moment, and ask us to do some reading. And I think I have enough for at least every two people to look along. But before I do that, I just thought we might open things up a bit just to see, when you hear the word erotic, what you associate with it. So what I'd like you to do, I'm going to go to the board and just call out words that come to your mind when you hear the word erotic.
Adult movies.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Sex. Sensuality. Passion.
Anything else, or is that pretty well captured?
Nudity.
A genre of writing.
I think that's a pretty good list. Okay. What I'd like us to do then, I'm going to pass out this handout and tell you a little bit about its context. If you would just take one for every two people. And then as we read it together, and I'll read it out loud and you can follow along, I think that's easier. And I'm going to read it instead of asking one of you to read it, simply because the copy didn't always come out so good, and it will be hard, I think, if you don't already know the text, to read it. And then, as we read it, I want you to bear in mind the range of terms that occurred to us, and see whether or not these figure prominently in this story that we're about to read. First of all, a little bit about the context. This short piece, or story, or myth, I think is the best way of putting it, this myth about Eros, about erotic longing, comes from a speech given by a comic poet, Aristophanes, who appears in a character in one of Plato's dialogues called the Symposium. The Symposium is an unusual dialogue in that it consists not of a sustained kind of conversation, but it takes place at a drinking party where people are pretty well inebriated when the contest begins, which is to see who can give the best speech in praise of love. This text comes from a culture that was very dominantly male in its thinking about these matters, and was deeply charged with homoerotic relationships throughout. And so the kind of paradigm in this text for what it means to be involved in a love relationship is love between a man and another man, though as you'll see in this text, that is not the only form of erotic relationship that's discussed. It makes room, as you will also notice, for there being in human nature a variety of different kinds of attractions of men to men, women to women, and men to women. And it lifts up for us, I think, if we read it closely, a number of features of erotic longing that apply to not people just then, but, and here's our question, to what extent does it challenge our own range of associations with eros, but to what extent does it begin to get at some of the things that are true of us in our relationships one to another that have a kind of erotic character to them? So, with those kinds of questions in mind, how prominently do terms like that figure in this story? How different is this world from our own? Let me read the story that comes from Aristophanes, remember, a comic poet. And it begins on page 316 here, right after those little X's. I will try to describe his power, that is the power of the god Eros, to you. And you shall teach the rest of the world what I am teaching you. And here begins the story. Everybody got access to one of these? Can
no, look along? This is a different one. It starts with the page 165.
I think you got a hold of something else. I'm sorry. Anybody got a copy that...
I got copies back here.
There were only... Okay, there weren't enough then. I'm sorry. But everybody else has one to two. Okay. Okay, so here's the story he's going to tell, and this is a myth of the beginnings of Eros. In the first place, let me treat of the nature of humankind and what has happened to it. For the original human nature was not like the present, but different. In the beginning, things were different from the way they are now. The sexes were not two, as they are now, but originally three. There was man, woman, and the union of the two, having a name corresponding to this double nature, which had once a real existence, but is now lost. And the word androgynous is only preserved now as a term of reproach. So originally, there were these three kinds, male, female, androgynous. In the second place, the primeval human was round, his back and sides forming a circle, and he had four hands and 4 feet, one head with 2 faces looking opposite ways, set on a round neck and precisely alike. Also, 4 ears, 2 privy members, and the remainder to correspond. He could walk upright as men do now, backwards or forwards as he pleased, and he could also roll over and over at a great pace, turning on his 4 hands and 4 feet, 8 in all, like tumbles going over and over with their legs in the air. This was when he wanted to run fast. Get this image in your mind. It comes from some of you may have read the Oz books, and there's one of the Oz books that has a group of characters in them called Wheelies. And I think the Wheelies were probably modeled after these strange beings. What you have here is my artistic talents aren't great. You have 2 sets of hands and 2 sets of feet and a kind of head perched on a neck which has a face that looks this way and a face that looks that way. Okay? So that this creature can kind of walk forwards or backwards or kind of as a wheelie would when it really wants to move along in a formidable way, roll around. Now, I realize this picture sounds comic and looks comic to us. In a way, to the listeners of this story, this would have seemed in a way to be closer to a kind of perfection because the circular form was thought to be the kind of perfect form. And so this body, even though it seems silly to us, If we can get out of what we take for granted and look at this body, it would seem to some of the listeners to be kind of superior to our own forms. And that should become clearer as we read along. So we've got these, in the beginning, were three wheelies. Yes?
When it says it's back and sides were round, does that mean it's like a turtle, flat on the bottom? Flat on the front?
I think the best way to picture it is sort of a one of those discs like you shoot in trap shooting, you know? In other words, it's not a globe, okay? It's round like this, but it has a kind of depth as well. I think that's the way I've always pictured it. It has some dimensions. It's not one-dimensional, flat, but it's not perfectly global either.
Like an M&M.
An M&M. That's good. In the beginning were three M&Ms. So far, so good. Now the sexes were three, and such as I have described them, because the sun, moon, and earth are three. And the man was originally the child of the sun, the woman of the earth, and the man-woman of the moon, which is made up of sun and earth. And they were all round and moved round and round like their parents. Terrible was their might and strength, and the thoughts of their hearts were great, and they made an attack upon the gods. Of them is told the tale of Otus and Ephialtes, who, as Homer says, dared to scale heaven and would have laid hands upon the gods. Doubt reigned in the celestial councils. Should they kill them and annihilate the race with thunderbolts, as they had done the giants, then there would be an end of the sacrifices and worship which men offered to them. But, on the other hand, the gods could not suffer their insolence to be unrestrained. At last, after a good deal of reflection, Zeus discovered a way. He said, "Methinks I have a plan which will humble their pride and improve their manners. Humans shall continue to exist, but I will cut them in two. And then they will be diminished in strength and increased in numbers. This will have the advantage of making them more profitable to us. They shall walk upright on two legs. And if they continue insolent and will not be quiet, I will split them again, and they shall hop about on a single leg." He spoke and cut men in two, like a sorb apple, which is halved for pickling, or as you might divide an egg with a hair. And as he cut them one after another, he bade Apollo give the face and the half of the neck a turn, in order that the human might contemplate the section of himself or herself. He would thus learn a lesson of humility. Apollo was also bidden to heal their wounds and compose their forms. So he gave a turn to the face and pulled the skin from the sides all over that which in our language is called the belly, like the purses which draw in. And he made one mouth at the center, which he fastened in a knot, the same which is called the navel. He also molded the breast and took out most of the wrinkles, much as a shoemaker might smooth leather upon a last. He left a few, however, in the region of the belly and navel as a memorial to the primeval state. Okay, so we have now an act of surgery performed in which these original creatures are cut in half. The heads, which would be facing this way, are now turned inward so that they're facing the jagged parts where the surgery has been performed. But then all of this messy flesh where the cut has been made is taken by Apollo and the skin folded around and drawn together like you would the drawstrings of a purse around the navel. And there you have now these creatures, which, in the words of a strong by Barbara Streisand, which goes, first you were half, now you're whole, kind of reverses that process. First you're whole, now you're half. And this is, remember, done as a kind of punishment for insolence shown on the part of the creatures at the beginning who aspired to deity. Now, already, and we're going to get to this in our discussion, some muffled bell should be going off in some of your minds, because here's a story, a great myth, which has creatures at the beginning being in some sense insolent, there being a deity who performs an act of radical surgery, changing the character of the original way in which the humans were, and changing that character, in this case, in part, in a response to an act of insolence. So now we have different beings walking around, and let's see what happens to them. And we still haven't gotten to Eros, of course. After the division, the two parts of the human, each desiring the other half, came together, and throwing their arms about one another, entwined in mutual embraces, longing to grow into one. They were on the point of dying from hunger and self-neglect, because they did not like to do anything apart. And when one of the halves died, and the other survived, the survivor sought another mate, man or woman, as we call them, being the sections of entire men or women, and clung to that. They were being destroyed when Zeus, in pity of them, invented a new plan. So here comes surgery number two. He turned the parts of generation round to the front. For this had not been always their position. And they sowed the seed no longer as hitherto, like grasshoppers in the ground, but in one another. And after the transposition of the male, after the transposition, the male generated in the female in order that by the mutual embraces of man and woman they might breed and the race might continue. Or if man came to man, they might be satisfied and rest and go their ways to the business of life. So ancient is the desire of one another which is implanted in us, reuniting our original nature, making one of two, and healing the state of human. Each of us, when separated, having one side only, like a flat fish, is but the indenture of a human, and he or she is always looking for his or her other half. Men who are a section of that double nature, which was once called androgynous, are lovers of women. Adulterers are generally of this breed, and also adulterous women who lust after men. The women who are a section of the woman do not care for man, but have female attachments. The female companions are of this sort. But they who are a section of the male follow the male, and while they are young, being slices of the original man, they hang about men and embrace them, and are themselves the best of boys and youths, because they have the most manly nature. Some indeed assert that they are shameless, but this is not true, for they do not act thus from any want of shame, because they are valiant and manly, and have a manly countenance, etc., etc. Okay, I'm going to skip down. You see where it's number two? So I don't want to take up all our time reading. For the intense yearning which each of them has toward the other does not appear to be the desire of lovers' intercourse, but of something else which the soul of either evidently desires and cannot tell, and of which she has only a dark and doubtful presentiment. Okay, so let me just explain what's happened here. After this act of surgery here, the sexual parts were still on the backsides, and now Zeus, taking pity upon these people, who immediately fly to embrace each other, having been torn from their other halves, and they get no work done, and they don't eat, and all the appetites are overtaken by this longing to be in one another's embrace, takes pity, moves the organs of generation around in the act of the second surgery, and now when people come together, if they're male and female, they procreate in this manner. If they're male and male or female and female, they become satisfied sexually in a kind of, as do the male and female become satisfied sexually, and then in that intense moment, release some of that longing, and then can get about daily life for a time until that longing builds up again in the form of that kind of physical sex drive, and then they come together and they discharge that longing and go about their business, etc., etc. And that permits them to live, because otherwise they would simply expire in each other's arms. The longing is so tremendous, overwhelming, and powerful. Okay, so now to the bottom of 318. Just a brief story which suggests that if Hephaestus, the great blacksmith, were asked, offered to weld people together who were once wholes and are now halves, would they agree to that? And the answer that Aristophanes gives is yes, what people most deeply want is to be re-welded, reunited to their other half. And then to pick it up at three, why is this? The reason is that human nature was originally one and we were whole. And the desire and pursuit of the whole is called eros. So here's now the definition that comes out of the story. What is erotic longing? What is eros? It's the desire and the pursuit of the whole. Okay? There was a time, I say, when we were one. But now, because of the wickedness of mankind, God has dispersed us, as the Arcadians were dispersed into villages by the Lacedaemonians. And if we are not obedient to the gods, there is a danger that we shall be split up again and go about in basso relievo like the profile figures, having only half a nose, which are sculptured on monuments, and that we shall be like tallies, in other words, there'll be further divisions. Wherefore, let us exhort all humans to piety, that we may avoid evil and obtain the good of which love is to us the Lord and minister. And let no one oppose him, he is the enemy of the gods who oppose him. For if we are friends of God and at peace with him, we shall find our own true loves, which rarely happens in this world at present. I am serious, and therefore I must beg Eryximachus not to make fun or find any allusion in what I am saying to Pausanias and Agathon. They were the previous speakers in this context, who, as I suspect, are both of the manly nature and belong to the class which I have been describing. But my words have a wider application. They include men and women everywhere. And I believe that if our loves were perfectly accomplished, and each one returning to his primeval nature had his original true love, then our race would be happy. And if this would be best of all, the best in the next degree and under present circumstances must be the nearest approach to such a union, and that will be the attainment of a congenial love. Wherefore, if we would praise him who has given to us the benefit, we must praise the God of love, who is our greatest benefactor, both leading us in this life back to our own nature and giving us high hopes for the future. For he promises that if we are pious, he will restore us to our original state and heal us and make us happy and blessed. When I was listening to Dan Erlander's Bible study this morning, wonderful Bible study on Isaiah, and he concluded with some talk about exiles and his sense that in a way we're all exiles through Christian baptism from our contemporary culture, I was thinking again of the great Genesis story and how, in another sense, as human beings, Christian or not, we're all exiles in the sense that we're all exiles from Eden, all driven out of an original state of wholeness and harmony, and in some sense longing for that. And then was thinking of this story and about how this story, again, has this picture, though of course very different in many ways from the Genesis picture, of an original state of wholeness, where there were no strangers, people were integral, and then there was this division, and then the story of love is the story of a longing for wholeness, love being the name, erotic love, for the pursuit of wholeness, that original unity with an other. So we're radically incomplete, and we long for completion in the arms of another, according to this story, and love is the name for that longing. Let's look now back at our terms. Adult movies, sex, fun, sensuality, passion, nudity, and a genre of writing. How prominently do you think those notions, I think it's fair to say that most, not everyone, but most of them are in the very near neighborhood of sex and sexuality, okay? I don't want to say that everybody had that primarily in mind, but I do think there's a kind of field of energy up there that focuses very sharply on human sexuality as being the primary associate with the term eros. How primary do you think that notion is in this myth? Human sexuality, when you're trying to get at what Eros is about. Story I just read.
It doesn't seem primary to me.
Doesn't seem primary. Mm-hmm. And why not? Can you give a reason why it doesn't seem primary?
Because the original myth has more to do with the oneness, coming back to the oneness, than sex always is thought of as kind of a release of energies, or it seems very different to me.
Good. Yes, if you'll notice that the longing called Eros comes into being before anything having to do with sexuality comes into being. Sexuality comes into being as a kind of remedy for that first condition, or if not a remedy, comes in, comes out of pity. Zeus moves the organs of generation around and so forth and so on. And if you look at the Genesis story in chapter 2, the second creation story, after the human is formed and placed into the garden to till it and to keep it, and after the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil are placed there, the Creator says, it's not good for this earth creature to be alone. And so the rest of that chapter 2 is taken up by the Creator fashioning first the animals, and then finally performing an act of surgery on the human, out of which male and female come. So again, what precedes any notion of sexuality in Genesis, just like here, is this longing for companionship, or this longing for kind of completion in the presence of another. Now, it works out very differently in the Genesis story, of course, from the way it works out here. But what I'm suggesting to you is that both in the Jewish story, that powerful one that was developed during the exile period that you learned about this morning, and in the Greek here, Aristophanes' comic tale, Eros is only secondarily connected to what, just in terms of our quick associations in contemporary culture, it's primarily associated with today, which is human sexuality. Does that make sense to you? Do you feel that? Yes.
What's striking me is that we are such a shame, we associate with shame with sex. I mean, if we can back off and think of sexual love or physical love and remove it from shame, it matches. I mean, there was no, you know, the line in Genesis, and they were both naked and neither were ashamed. And as you listen to this, the sense of there's no shame involved with this, and we bring so much baggage of shame to matters of sex, it's hard to. And that's where this kind of coming for me, because I can't get past the shame that we've just been taught goes with sex.
To the rest of you on that, do you think that the reason that our culture thinks when it hears the word Eros, and when we really, and we name it vaguely for that kind of affection that's rooted in desire, rooted in a kind of longing for something. We'll leave it open whether the Greeks are right and what's longing for is wholeness. Do you think the reason we associate it with sexuality is that sexuality is bound up with shame for us? Do you think those two things, what this gentleman just named, and our tendency to associate Eros right away with sexuality are connected? Yes.
Well, I think part of it is we don't use the word Eros, we use erotica and erotic things, which in my mind immediately is on that level. So Eros and erotica may not mean the same, but they sound the same.
I think it's something to what he says, but I'm wondering where we develop the other words for love too, the even Greek words, filial, agape, those are all
great group.
How did they evolve?
Well, the same culture that produced Eros also produced important works, some of which we'll look at next week, on friendship and on agape. Mm-hmm. And those were seen, I mean, there's a kind of richer potential in having a number of different words for love. And some of the contrasts we'll be drawing up as we go on. Mm-hmm. Ours tends, since we use the word love to cover tremendous territory, we tend to get confused, I think, a little more than we need to because of our impoverished vocabulary. But I think even more so, judged by the standards of the Greeks, at least on this one point, that we tend to associate immediately that erotic longing, that longing for completion, that kind of passion that we long for in the embrace of another, we associate it with sexuality primarily, and sometimes even some would say exclusively. And I think that makes us look overlook things. I mean, for example, let's take how this practically affects our lives. How many young people today will say, look, the grounds for my marriage, if there is to be one, has got to be sexual compatibility and excitement and satisfaction, and has got to be the kind of thrilling, erotic passion that most people name with these words, okay? And that companionship would just have to develop later, okay? Or, conversely, older people who say, look, I just don't have that kind of spark of eros, meaning that set of things, and therefore I think something's wrong with my marriage, my relationship, whatever you want to call it. In both the Genesis story and in this story, what comes first is companionship. What our culture often does, not only in terms of how we think, but how we act, what seems to come first in the order of time and in the order of importance is this physical erotic stuff. And what these stories are suggesting to us is that the ground of this longing, its very nature, is after something much more profound, a kind of reunion of bodies and souls, a kind of longing for completion. Now, whether that completion can ever come in the arms of one other person is another question, but I'll leave that aside for right now. Is this all making sense to people? I mean, does anybody want to dissent or register a complicating insight about us or the story?
I just think it's a very American thing to separate sexuality and love. Quick to look at the history of our country, but that's not true in so many other countries, that there's the shame associated and that we have to separate things so much. I think it's something we've done to ourselves here in contemporary America more than most other countries.
Okay.
I venture to say.
Yes.
I'm not really sure what to do with this idea, but it just keeps coming to me the way that I have, and people do use sex to create an artificial intimacy with this, and it's maybe you have that need for companionship and some sort of spiritual connection, but the relationship doesn't contain that, and so somehow the sex creates it. And I don't know how to fit that into what you're saying. I think it's part of the idea, but I don't know what to do with it.
No, that's very interesting. Could you explain a little more? You're thinking of sex as a, what, again? Substitute, did you say?
I think that sometimes it can create a sense of artificial intimacy that isn't genuinely present in the relationship.
Because it's so overwhelming as far as a feeling, it can mask the fact that at any depth, there's not much.
It can create a sense that there is depth, but where there isn't, there isn't really that the depth that comes from true companionship and true person-to-person connection. But you still want that kind of connection, and so if you can't get it in a genuine way, some people will try to get it in a way that circumvents the long, full path by just.
Very nice, yes. So sex is a kind of quick fix.
Yeah.
In other words, it's a sort of, if there is this hunger in us for wholeness, one can get the quick fix through sex, but that does not satisfy.
Well, it's almost like a symbol, too. It's a symbol for
the depth of companionship or that deep longing. And so if you have that, then somehow symbolically you have the rest of it, even if it's not there.
It reminds me of that discussion yesterday about advertising and women's images and that, and the whole idea of advertising selling us the symbols of true substance. You know, we're not really getting the really fulfilling substance. We're just getting something that someone tells us we'll do it when it doesn't.
Yes.
Well, marrying for love is a fairly recent phenomenon, because in much earlier times, people married in order to create a family, keep the family name going, etc. And love was reserved for, you know, the troubadour sang about love, and it was this passionate sexual love always happened outside of marriage. So to bring together marriage and passionate sex is a fairly recent phenomenon.
Thank you. You can teach the next class. That's what the next class is going to be about. It's going to be about the troubadours and exactly your point about how some of that was seen as love outside of marriage. Exactly. When I ask I can talk to the students in my class very seriously about these matters, and they'll say the kinds of things that you've said about how this notion of erotic longing defined more narrowly than the Greeks defined it as sexual passion. They will all agree that that ought not be the foundation for a marriage. And then we'll go on talking, and I'll say to them with a straight face that I really think that what we should do and recommend, at least on the BU campus, is that we go back to the ways and simply let parents pick their spouse. Do you think that any one of them goes along with that idea? That we should basically see this in a broader social context and with parents having certain wisdom about finding someone who's a suitable companion, and then those other things will develop later. Well, I always have to keep from being stoned because they think that I am saying this with a straight face. So you can sort of, I do that just to make them feel the tension in what they think. They kind of agree that they've had enough experience by that time to see that sex is at best a quick fix. If you're not combining that with richer understandings of human beings relating to one another and the depth of what erotic longing really is. But to think then that we ought to have some other situation other than what we now have for joining people together as husband and wife makes them very frightened. I mean, they just can't. They can't imagine that and so forth. So, in other words, what I'm saying, in their practice, they actually and some of us may as well have a difference between what we practice and what we preach on this matter in contemporary culture. Let me ask this question to take up a different. Go ahead, Ingrid.
This I'm afraid
isn't
a very well-formed idea, but you talk about sex. Adding a layer of depth or meaning to having sex when you love the person. And we talk about arranged marriages and marriages of convenience and marriages of a good match for one reason or another. I mean, my sister-in-law's Japanese, and, you know, that whole culture felt that they should arrange. And you know, pastors, single pastors coming out of the seminary up until not long ago, if they went to a parish, the parish felt it was their obligation to find a good wife. And so then sex in marriage, these arranged marriages or marriages of family or marriages of older, wealthier men being allowed to sort of pick off the brightest young, nubile woman in the community who was 16. And where was satisfaction in sex in marriage is what I'm getting at. Marriage then became the method of procreation. I mean, it was pretty easy for the sex act to take place, evidently, and it was sufficient, at least so that the sperm was injected into vaginas and women got pregnant. The model of marriage that we're all handed down, and we sort of assume, is that marriage somehow involves wonderful sex in addition to procreation.
But it's sounding pretty empty to me from this conversation. I'm thinking that wasn't the case. Now, maybe those marriages, arranged marriages or marriages convening to something, grew into some good mutual sex. I think of sex as having mutuality, of being wonderful when it is mutual, that there's mutual pleasuring of one another and respect for one another, and that women actually have orgasms in that kind of sex, as opposed to either faking it or just passively lying there until the guys come. I'm sensing that there's a lot of problems with this.
I think there are a lot of problems, and I think that we begin to get at them when we wonder, in these stories and some of the ones we tell ourselves today, about the relation among sexuality, procreation, marriage, companionship. Okay? In other words, you could write the whole history in the West of love and marriage by noticing how at different times we've tended to uncouple some of those from the other three. And how increasingly at this point we've begun to uncouple all four from one another, so that sometimes we have pure sex, companionship, marriage without either of those, marriage with just one of those, et cetera, et cetera. And I think in some ways what we've done, what you were saying, is onto marriage, we've at one extreme loaded so many expectations, marriages couldn't possibly fulfill them, which I think is what you were getting at, and I quite agree with you. And that was your point earlier about the companionate marriage as opposed to the marriage which is exposed to fulfill everything, sexual, companionship, children, etc. And that we've just, at one extreme, overloaded it so that at the other extreme, we just have them failing by the scores and by the hundreds.
And we certainly, I teach college students and I have teenagers, and so I get involved in sex ed sometimes with these kids. We certainly want to talk to them about sex as being a means of expression of love and a way of deepening a relationship, and you want to make an argument against recreational sex, which is what kids are sort of taught by our culture is expected of them. And yet what we're hearing here is that there's a long tradition of superficiality in sex that seemed to have worked pretty well for human beings. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should re-look at this and see, maybe we should tell our friends recreational sex is just fine. Mm-hmm. Humans are capable of it, they like it, it gives you a little comfort for a while.
And some cultures
have done that. Yes!
Some cultures have done that.
Where are we going?
Yes.
Well, isn't some of this an evolution, like our culture is evolving, you know, nothing stays stagnant, so families change, countries change, boundaries change. At one time we had isolated little areas where they had their own cultures and their own way of teaching sexuality. But then when the airplane flew in and brought people from another world, it changed it all. I think that there's a lot of change and a lot of latitude, but there's also responsibility for what happens. And that's where you're at. You have to be responsible for what happens. Mm-hmm.
Yes?
I just keep thinking about the economic dependence of women and the need to form families in order to be economic units and that sort of thing. And then I started thinking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs and wondering if we've gotten to a state of luxury where now we can ask for genuine intimacy in a relationship rather than just an economic contract. And then I started thinking about this, and what really is the hierarchy of needs then? You know, if this reuniting of beings is so basic, maybe that is one of the most basic needs that we're finally waking up to, realizing that nothing was working very well when we're getting that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nice point. Other ones on this cultural evolution and change and where we are now, kind of? Yes?
I just want to comment. I spent 2 years in New Guinea, and they do, lots of them still have arranged marriages, at least when I did my 2 years there. And it's very interesting to me that lots of the boys said, oh, that's fine with them, but it wasn't okay for the women. And it seems to me that one of the things that's changed in our whole recent culture is that women have more choices. And then one feels like we don't have as many choices as we want, even now. And that has more to do with economics, I think, than some other things. But it seems to me that we're still in an evolutionary pattern of it that is considering a whole lot of different differences now than were our parents or grandparents. And birth control is a big one. The church used to say, no, it didn't make any difference, but I think it does.
When the two of you used the word evolution, did you mean to use that in a kind of normative sense, like we're getting better and better, or did you just mean change, kind of a neutral change?
I think both. I think we're getting more aware. Mm-hmm. We have more sources of education. You know, there was a time when people didn't even have books. So the only knowledge they had was their own culture. Now we are, I think, our society, or the whole world is becoming more aware. Whether that's better, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, one final question I'll leave you with, because we're coming to an end. I would like to leave people with questions rather than the sense we've wrapped everything up. One of the troubling things about this myth, which I still think haunts us, and we're going to find things that haunt us on Wednesday from the medieval period that are much more troublesome. But this is troublesome to me. One of the dimensions of this myth is the notion that there's only one other half out there. And that still is percolating around in people's thinking, well, there's that perfect someone. And until I find that someone, I'm going to be miserable, okay? So this puts an enormous weight, not simply on another human being in completeness. Mm-hmm. And finally, I think the wisdom of Christianity and other religions as well on this is that somehow to ask another human being to complete our neediness is to put too much strain on that human being and to be deeply unrealistic about what we finally are searching for. I mean, when takes St. Augustine, our hearts are restless till they rest in thee, it gets at a depth of our spiritual longing that's not contemplated in Aristophanes' story, okay? Because Aristophanes' story would have it that we could finally be whole and complete just in the arms of another. And I think that's very suspicious. So that's one thing that worries me about this myth. But the other one is that completion can only take place in the arms of an other. And that means that you can just imagine. I don't need to spell out the implications of that, and how that still percolates around some people who both think that they're on a hopeless quest. They've never found that number one, so can never be whole, which is a sad and tragic, needlessly tragic frame of mind. But it's fed by that kind of myth of the one half that you're separated from, that you spend your life trying to find, and it also has a lot to say about grieving and so forth. When one's other half does die, then what is one to say about oneself then in the process of healing and grieving if there's only one other half that has made one complete? So I just want to point out there's some powerfully true things, I think, about this myth, and we've really dwelled for most of this time on that. That is the primacy of a longing deeper than sexuality. But there are also some troublesome things about this myth. And I leave you simply with the question, do you agree with the kind of underlying mythical truth here, Aristophanes, that there is just one other, or do you think that's a kind of destructive part about the myth?
Well, I think that this longing for connection, which is so primary, has been deeply affected by our assumptions and beliefs about sexuality, because how many of us are so defended because of our sexual beliefs that to just really open our hearts and arms to another person becomes difficult. I mean, we have all these defenses that are right there. We're so afraid of our sexuality and our sexual feelings, and that how many of us will just let ourselves be hugged by another person past a few seconds or something, or, you know, A-frame hugs, or, you know, that
Very nice. I think I'm going to accept that notion of the A-frame hub as the last word. And thank you all for being so attentive, and hope to see you all here on Wednesday when we go over stranger lovers, and talk a little bit about that medieval backstop, the art of courtly love. So we'll see you then. Well, that's because she and I are sharing a teaching position. And Neil, I think I'm going to speak to her. She said she likes you a lot, but it's strange that you've never met Facebook. So she wanted me to be sure to do this.
You know, this I just read a recent article about twins and the research that's been done on twins in the last years. And,
thank you.
Because you know, the egg is split. Mm-hmm. And this sounds so much like the, and how some twins have this strong longing for each other, even though they are split at birth and adopted out, which is getting into a whole other realm. But it gets into the realm that there's so much more in our psyche.
No, that's no, that's a good point. That does, because here you have almost a biological episode like this, where the egg, which is a whole one, splits. And twins have that kind of haunting union with one another that's almost mystical at times.
It was in a psychology magazine I was reading, and it was talking about how you know about the twins, but you don't know about the twin that didn't survive, and how sometimes the twin that survives still has a psychological yearning for the one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
No, that's a good point.
Mark, have you read anything that Nancy Fox has to say about Eros?
Actually, I read the, you mean Original Blessing?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to think what I read. I think it may be Original Blessing, but I thought it was a rather interesting way to structure this conversation. That I think, if I remember right, that the whole, all the traction is the larger umbrella. Mm-hmm. And that sexuality is part of, I mean, that is attraction. Eros is attraction. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my attraction or non-attraction to that painting or some tree or
right.
or any number of people, not just one person, so that then sexuality is one aspect of Eros. But it's a very, I mean, to me, that's a fairly attractive way of breaking into the conversation.
That is, in fact, the larger view of the symposium, if you read the whole book. When you get to Socrates' own speech.
What's the book? I've been there late, so...
The Symposium.
The one of
the Platonic Dialogues.
All right, I've read it.
And at the end, he gives us a speech and talks about what he learned from his teacher, who was a woman named Diotima. And he indicates that Eros is really something that is the name for a kind of general desire, mm-hmm. you know, for attraction.
Yeah.
And that the same thing can be true of our love for culture, our love for institutions,
music,
exactly. And so it really does become exactly that kind of word for him. Mm-hmm. He will have nothing to do with Aristophanes' view that we just have an other who would complete us.
Of course, I read it in college and I didn't understand it then because rather far beyond it. Yeah, I like. I mean, I was just saying, I finally got to see Liz Estrada.
What did you really?
I thought it was a great play. But I mean, it is funny to think that the Greeks were laughing that up and going to see that. And then there's a whole period of American history which it wasn't ever produced here.
That's right.
I didn't have a text, but isn't it true that the person who's incomplete can go to many others within this, the right kind?
No, the suggestion in this story is that there's just one other kind. I mean, you are always, when you are born, I'm sorry, you are going to be drawn to other women or other men or somebody of the opposite sex.
Right.
Actually, the thing that I like best about this myth, and the one point I think that has it over the Genesis story, is that it starts with those three. So that by nature, one is drawn to others, and sometimes those others are people of the same sex, and sometimes not. And so that somehow that's understood as being part of the original plan, rather than some deviation down the way. And that's the part I really press my teaching the students to look at the contrast and see where on that basis, at least, I think it has it over the... Because Genesis comes out of a culture that's so obsessed with families.
Yeah.
So there's that interpolation at the end of Genesis 2. And so a man leaves him to his wife or something like that. But it really wants to press the family agenda so deeply into that story that it can't imagine that there would be a kind of original creation in which the longing would be for an other, but not necessarily an other of the same.
But an other in order to appropriate them.
Exactly.
But the good thing about the Genesis story is that the differentiation to companions takes place not as a punishment,
right. But
as a gift.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's very important.
And that's very nice.
Yeah.
That's very nice. Yeah. And that's a worry about this story.
Mm-hmm. But it's a punishment that we should feel this way at all.
That's right.
Feel incomplete. Yeah. I mean, you'd be looking for something, looking for love, you know.
Yeah, it's really that. It's not a punishment. Analysis for young people today, because it's much more important for them to feel complete in themselves and bring their completeness to a relationship, mm-hmm. and never lose that completeness in the relationship, mm-hmm. especially for young women. Mm-hmm. Rather than feeling like part of a person until you're hooked on something else, you're only complete as much as you're
really.
Still compare attached and used. That's always a put down. He's always a put down.
Right. Some little jive.
Yeah.
Person.
My bitter cat. Everybody knows that she isn't. You know, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Or actually, everybody knows she is for somebody. I don't know what.
Speaking of.
Yeah. Yes, I was trying to. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to go back and research your stories. But this is fun.
Thank you. This was fun. Thank you.
You still have to figure out what the form is going to be around.
I was just going to ask you.
Keep an ear to the ground while you're doing it.
What are the going candidates?
Did you make any arrangements with the troll regarding lunch? No.
What are the going candidates?
I've got a suggestion.
What?
Well, when I first came in, I thought it would be fun to do something about the military as the moral guardian of our values in this country and look at it. I mean, I thought it was just astonishing that we had this whole thing with the woman pilot and then this guy that was denied, you know. And you think, what would the church do? The church just fire them both, or would they call them and say, now listen.